And thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Voters are casting their ballots for the city's Board of Education, what you should know about the historic election.
A budget that strives to give all the people under our jurisdiction the best possible life.
We break down Cook County's nearly $10 billion budget proposal and how the Chicago-based founder of the Harlem Globetrotters shook up the sports world. And now to today's top stories. A University of Chicago professor can now add Nobel Prize winner to his list of accomplishments.
I was sleeping in bed, and my wife woke me up. I turned my phone off at night, so I didn't really... They called me at 5:15, except that I was sleeping and the phone was off. So one of her friends texted her and woke her up. So that's how we know.
Professor James A. Robinson, along with two MIT economists, brought home the 2024 Nobel Prize in Economics for their research explaining why some countries are wealthier than others. The scholars began by outlining historical moments that contributed to extreme income gaps and found that systems made to benefit European migrants, like the system set up in the United States, have more long-term success. The nearly 50,000 runners that took over streets yesterday are now gone. So with the excitement of the 46th Chicago Marathon now over, the 26-plus mile course that begins and ends at Grant Park is in the midst of being cleaned up. A big congratulations to Kenya this year. Both the men's and women's winners are from the East African country. Ruth Chepngetich set a new world record at 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 56 seconds. And John Carrier ran an impressive 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 44 seconds. Music, dancing, and controversy all accompany today's annual Columbus Day Parade, celebrating the city's Italian-American community and honoring the divisive historical figure, Christopher Columbus. Columbus Day is still an observed holiday in Chicago and Illinois, while some institutions, including Chicago Public Schools, recognize and celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. The Native American Guardian Association participated in the parade. Their performance has been panned by the Chicago American Indian Community Collaborative, which said in a statement that the association does not properly represent the city's Native American community. Up next, what you should know about Chicago's school board election. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago residents are getting their first crack at picking members to serve on the city's Board of Education. For decades, the 7-member board has been appointed by the mayor. But now, voters in next month's election will pick members in 10 districts, and the mayor will select 11 more as the board triples in size to a total of 21 members. Joining us now with more on what you should know about that election is WTTW News reporter Matt Masterson. Welcome back, Matt. So, you know, first let's back up a little bit and tell us how we got to this point. How did the elected school board come to be on the ballot?
So Chicago has had a mayorally appointed board since 1995. As you said, it's been decades. And the push to give control back to voters has been going on nearly as long. It's been a very long process until finally in 2021, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation that would do just that, convert this board into one that is an elected body chosen by the public. Now, that isn't happening all at once. After this election cycle, the board will jump from 7 members to 21, and those will be split in half between those who were voted by the public and those appointed this time by Mayor Johnson. But because of the way that's broken up, the board will actually remain under majority mayoral control through this cycle of elections until 2026, during the following round of elections, when it will be fully elected for the first time.
Okay, so what will folks actually be voting for this time?
Yeah, so the city has been broken up into 10 different districts for the school board. Chicagoans will elect one board member from each of those 10 districts. Mayor Johnson will then appoint a second member from each of those districts. But Johnson, the reason he'll have majority control is he also gets to pick an at-large president resident. He will serve from anywhere in the city. He doesn't have to pick in any particular district, but that will mean he has control over appointing 11 of the 21 members. Once that board is all settled, those members will each serve 2 years. It's an unpaid term until 2026, when their board will then again be fully elected. All 21 members will be chosen by the public.
Which means it sounds like the folks who get elected this time, if they wanted to, could run again in 2026.
Exactly, right.
So what are the board members' responsibilities?
Well, there's a lot of them. They approve the annual operating budget, which is now closing in on $10 billion. They're tasked with hiring and potentially firing the CPS CEO, which is something that's obviously been a point of contention recently between with ongoing tensions between Mayor Brandon Johnson and CPS CEO Pedro Martinez. The mayor cannot fire the CPS CEO. It has to be done through the board, which, of course, the current board, seven members of it just resigned, so it's new appointees who could choose to do that going forward. But they also really help set up district policy at large. They approve the annual school calendar. They pick student code of conduct guidelines for each school. And more broadly, they take on larger issues like eliminating police officers from schools, which the previous board, the outgoing board, just did earlier this year.
Okay, Matt Masterson explaining the future of Chicago Elected School Board for us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And to find out who is running in your district, be sure to check out our WTTW News Voter Guide. It's a one-stop shop for everything you need to know before voting. You'll find candidate profiles and questionnaires, as well as key dates to know and whether you are registered to vote. That is all at WTTW.com/voterguide. Up next, one-on-one with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle on the budget proposal for the county. Cook County has announced a, quote, good news budget for fiscal year 2025. Unlike the city of Chicago with its looming budget holes and, quote, everything's on the table approach, including tax hikes, the county's $9.9 billion proposal, up 6.8% compared to last year, includes no plans to increase taxes, cut services, or lay off any workers to cover a $218 million projected budget gap.
This year's $9.9 billion balanced budget and our strong financial position aren't by chance. They are the product of smart policies year after year.
Joining us now with more on the county budget is Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Madam President, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what are the priorities and investments of this budget?
Well, our budget is $9.9 billion, as you heard. 53% of it, $5.9 billion, is health care. Half of our budget is health care. Stroger Hospital, Provident Hospital, and our dozen primary care clinics and specialty clinics. 17% is public safety, so that's the courts and the jails, and so that's 70% public health and public safety, and then 30% is everything else we do.
Forest preserves, et cetera.
Well, no, the forest preserves
have got a separate budget.
Yeah, no, but it's infrastructure work, it's our violence prevention work, it's our economic development work, it's animal control, it's everything in the kitchen sink that's the other 30%.
A lot of work. You, as we mentioned, you'd previously expected or projected a $218 million shortfall, but this budget is balanced, no taxes, fees, or fines, as we mentioned. How did you do it?
Well, we have a great team headed by Tanya Anthony, our Bureau of Finance, and we've made some tough decisions and hard choices, and our commissioners have been good enough to go along with those tough decisions and hard choices for 14 years. So we've got ourselves in a pretty good place.
What would you say those tough decisions, hard choices were for you all?
Well, when I first came into office, there was almost a $500 million budget gap to close, $487 million, and it required 15% cuts pretty much across the board. It was a brutal year. The next year, it was more than $300 million. So gradually, we've been able to get control of the finances, and frankly, having us on a firm financial footing has enabled us to take on some of the policy challenges that we wanted to address.
One of the things that you all have done is you are keeping 56 jobs unfilled, and that adds to the 3,600-plus jobs that are already vacant across Cook County, mostly in healthcare and public safety operations. Does that impact, as you mentioned, the 70% of your budget, which is, you know, healthcare and public safety, do those positions being empty, does that impact the services that those agencies provide?
You know, we've had some challenges, as other units of government and, frankly, corporations have had, as we've come out of the pandemic and trying to fill positions. Things have gotten better in the last year or so. Those vacancies are particularly in healthcare.
Uh-oh, sorry. Need a little bit of water.
Right.
Not the first person it's
right.
happened to. Particularly in healthcare, you say, obviously, yeah. because there's 53% of your budget there.
That's right. So, but, you know, we're going to work over the year to fill those positions, and we believe that we can deliver great services with our present staffing levels, but we know that we have a ways to go.
This budget does not include another year of the guaranteed basic income program that was piloted over the last 2 years, Cook County Promise. What is the plan for that program going forward?
Well, when we said we were going to do this as a pilot, we partnered with the University of Chicago Inclusive Economy Lab, and they have looked not just at our participants and outcomes for them, but a control group as well, just like you do a medical test. And we'll be getting out the last checks to participants in January, and then the University of Chicago will begin its evaluation and analysis. And we'll look at the outcomes and figure out how we proceed. But I've committed that this is not the end of that program. We'll continue.
What does preliminary research show about that program?
That people use it for what you'd expect, you know, food and utilities and rent, and to meet financial emergencies. So, you know, I think we're going to be able to show that this is at a real positive benefit for the families that have been involved. It's 3,250 families, $500 a month for 2 years.
This program was funded using the ARPA dollars, the COVID dollars, as a lot of us refer to them. And as we all know, that money is running out for many agencies. What is the status of the county's ARPA allocations?
Well, like everyone else, our money will run out at the end of 2026. So we've got to figure out what we're going to do in terms of continuing programs, which ones will terminate, which ones will reduce in size, and which ones will carry on. But, you know, our budget team has given us a step down rather than a cliff. So we've put money aside so that we can fund over the next 4 years after the money runs out until 2030, those programs that we think are most impactful. And we can also have a kind of a glide path so that we can look for external resources, whether it's grant programs from the state or federal government, or whether it's philanthropy to help us meet the needs that we think we need to address.
Does that include Cook County Promise, the guaranteed basic income program as well, since it's something that's not happening for 2025, but when you first initiated it, there were hopes and promises that you would be able to continue it beyond ARPA?
We are. We're going to use our own corporate dollars to fund it going beyond, but we're going to look at the evaluation first to see how we need to tweak the program in order to better make it more impactful.
Some municipalities, and you've kind of addressed this, but they're finding it difficult to keep some programming going once that ARPA funding is going. For example, we know this is something Chicago Public Schools is dealing with right now. How is Cook County going to continue? Like, I guess, what bucket of funds will cover something like Cook County Promise and other programs that you have to think about?
We put, I think it's $160 million, don't hold me to the exact number, but we put money aside, as I said, to step down in the years following 2026, so 27 through 30. Money has been set aside so that we can continue those programs, which we think have been critical, and give us a chance to find resources to fully fund the things that we believe have been proven up in the ARPA process.
Cook County Health has been without a permanent CEO for nearly a year. Dr. Eric Makaitis serving as interim CEO since last November. Thoughts on when the board of directors might appoint a permanent replacement?
The board of health for the health and hospital systems.
Yes, thank you.
We'll make a decision at the end of October, and that'll be followed up by a decision by the county board.
Okay. Budget also calls for making a I'm sorry, maybe it's something in the air, but the budget also calls for making a $568.3 million pension payment. How would you say that payment amount lines up with the county's pension responsibilities, and what is the status of the county's pension responsibility?
Well, in 2015, I asked our Board of Commissioners, and again, it was a tough vote, to raise the sales tax by one penny. And as a result, we have resources to meet our pension obligations and to invest in infrastructure. And when we did that, I promised that that's what we would do with the money. We weren't going to use it for regular operating expenses, and that's what we've done. And as a result, starting in 2016, we were able to make the actuarial required contribution rather than the statutory one. And what the actuaries believed was necessary was greater than the statute. So we had a memorandum of understanding every year from 2016 until last year with our pension board to give them more money so that we could c- catch up. And our pensions are funded at about 69%, which is very good for the state of Illinois. And we're on a path to 2040, I think, to be about 80%, 2050 to be about 80% funded, which is fully funded. So we made some tough choices starting in 2015. We made agreements with our pension fund to give them more money than the law required. And then finally, we got approval from the state of Illinois to make the actuarial contribution rather than the statutory one. So we no longer had to do these annual agreements with the pension board to give them more money.
Chicago, the city of Chicago, is struggling financially and in a bit of a mess at the moment. That budget report or proposal is formally coming later on. But how can these two municipalities that share the same space be so different financially? What do you say about what's happening in Chicago?
Well, first of all, I'm a teacher, but I don't give grades to other elected officials. And as I said, in the county side, we've made tough choices and hard decisions for 14 years. And so we're in a real good place, and I'm grateful to our finance teams over that period of time for bringing us here.
You used to work with with current Mayor Brandon Johnson, who is a former Cook County commissioner. What do you know about his work as a chief executive, and do you have any sort of empathy for him after having, you know, it's been a rough few weeks for him?
Well, you know, we work closely with both the state and the city. We have agreements around meeting the needs of new arrivals. We work together on the violence prevention initiative. So, and we collaborate with them on a variety of issues. So we have a working relationship with both the city and the state.
Okay. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Of course. Up next, we pass the ball to the Harlem Globetrotters. Stay with us. Globetrotters may have a New York name, but they actually started in Chicago. The players, along with founder Abe Saperstein, disrupted the game of basketball and gave it a whole new look. A new book, Globetrotter, How Abe Saperstein Shook Up the World of Sports, reveals the history and legacy of this storied team. Joining us is Mark Jacob, co-author of the new book, who is former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune. Mark, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote this book along with your brother.
Right.
What inspired you both to do this?
Well, we both love sports and the history of sports, and we both are fascinated by the history of racism in America. And, you know, this subject had both of those. And plus, it had a really inspirational story about a person and a team that came out of nowhere and really made an impact. So we loved it.
As we know, the Harlem Globetrotters, not from Harlem,
right?
But from Chicago. Why did Abe Saperstein choose that name?
Well, all right, so Abe Saperstein is this 5'3" Jewish guy from the North Side. And he's working in the Park District in Chicago, and he runs into these black athletes, talented black athletes on the South Side. They form a team, and they start traveling. And obviously, this is the 1920s, so we're talking, you know, a few years after the 1919 race riot in Chicago. So,
So
tensions were, you know, high, and misunderstanding was high. And so he's taking this team in a Model T Ford that they bought from a funeral parlor, so it had drapes on the sides so they could have a little privacy. So they're touring these Midwest towns, almost all white towns, you know, in the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Michigan, Illinois, and he wanted to signal to the folks that, hey, I'm bringing these black athletes into town, it's going to be fine. And I think so. That was why he said Harlem. It was a signal for black.
It indicated that these folks are black. Some say that, you know, he found these players, but others say that they already had a black coach before meeting Saperstein, but they were performing poorly. What was his role for those players and for the team?
Well, you know, he really did probably start out as a booking agent, where he was these black athletes on the South Side, you know, including a team called the Savoy Big Five, which was at the Savoy Ballroom on the South Side. They wanted to do barnstorming tours to make money, and they needed what they call a white face to negotiate everything for them. And Saperstein was that. Saperstein was a guy in his 20s who loved sports and was just a gregarious guy who could kind of get people to be in, you know, engaged with him. And so they hired him to do that, and eventually he became the coach of the team and took them around, and he invented the Harlem Globetrotters as their brand.
The first chapter, it's called The Disruptor, and it centers around that 1948 basketball game of the Globetrotters versus the Minneapolis Lakers,
right,
before they became the L.A. Lakers. Right. And now that I know they used to be in Minneapolis, it makes so much more sense.
Yes.
But why was that game significant?
Well, this was at a time, what needs to be understood, and we didn't, until we did our research, fully understand that back in those days, a lot of white people thought that black people weren't good enough to compete in sports, that they, especially team sports. Well, black players might be okay, but they're not really very good at team sports, or they choke in the clutch. There were all these bizarre myths that in today's world seemed like mind-blowingly stupid, but that was the way it was. And so Abe's team, the Globetrotters, is playing against the Minneapolis Lakers, who everyone thought was the best team in America and really in the world, because America was where basketball was invented. And they had an incredible game with a full house at Chicago Stadium in 1948, and the Globetrotters won on the last second shot. And it was this glorious moment that we recount in the book. And in many ways, it was significant for the whole history of the NBA, because 2 years later, the NBA desegregates and starts admitting black players. And many people thought that 1948 game was such a was so influential that white America could accept black players in the NBA, and everyone knew there was no way to keep them out anymore. It was proof that black players could compete.
At what point did they start to add sort of the comedy and the tricks and the Washington Generals?
You know, this is another thing that there are a lot of stories about that. In fact, Abe kind of told stories about, well, you know, we got bored one night and we had to get the fans interested. The truth is, according to our research, they always were a comic team. They were trying to win the games, but they also were trying to, you know, be entertaining. And the thing about it is they were playing, often they were going to these towns and playing factory teams or just college teams. They were beating them pretty badly, and they used the comedy to keep the crowds interested, and also so that they didn't humiliate the team so badly that they didn't want them back the next year, because they wanted everyone to go away happy, and they wanted them back the next year.
The Globetrotters, they were also, you know, back in the day, useful to the State Department.
Yes.
The U.S. State Department. Tell us a little bit about
that. This is where our book breaks ground on this, because after the war, you know, the Cold War is going on, and the Soviets are really seizing on Jim Crow South horrible things. In fact, there's a memo in which an ambassador tells the State Department, the Little Rock desegregation crisis is killing us over here. You got to bring the Globetrotters over here to show successful, talented black people who are not oppressed. And so Abe Saperstein and the Globetrotters worked with the State Department in many ways secretly to use the Globetrotters as a propaganda weapon during the Cold War.
Did the men, did the basketball players themselves ever feel any conflict about doing that, about like selling America as this great place, but at home knowing that them and their people are receiving the end of Jim Crow?
Well, there's a lot of tension in the book about that, you know, they knew they were trying to make a living, you know, to some extent. And they also were treated better. There's quotes in the book about them being treated better in Europe when they went over than they were treated in their own country. So they knew what was going on. But at the same time, they were treated as stars in Europe,
like.
and they were highly successful. And you know, the thing about Abe Saperstein is he gave a lot of jobs to black athletes at a time when people, you know, were struggling to get by.
Almost out of time, Mark, but you and your brother dedicated the book to Inman Jackson. Yeah. Who was he and what was the role that he played for them in about 30 seconds?
Yes. Inman Jackson was Abe Saperstein's best friend and was an early star of the Globetrotters and, in fact, invented many of their tricks and this. And like Abe Saperstein, he's really underappreciated. And we dedicated the book because we wanted people. We have more in the book about Inman Jackson than has ever been put in a book before, and we're proud of that.
Okay, Inman Jackson, we don't want to tell people about the whole book. They got to read it if they want to know more. Mark Jacob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, the book is called Globetrotter, How Abe Saperstein Shook Up the World of Sports, and it's out now. And that's our show for this Monday night. If you're looking for more context on the complicated issues that matter most to you, sign up for our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. You can do that at WTTW.com/newsletter. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And don't forget to check out our WTTW News Voter Guide for information you need to know to make informed decisions at the ballot box. It's coming up, folks. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.